Chapter 15. Abby and her mother returned to Brooklyn. The neurologist they'd consulted had said that Abby was physically healthy, without any neurological disease. He suggested they see a psychiatrist to treat Abby's mental illness. It was the first time Abby heard the words mentally ill in reference to herself. "Is that what all this has been about? Is that why I lose control? How did this happen, and why to me?" she thought. They arrived home tired, worn out, and discouraged. Abby had graduated from high school, so she wasn't sure what to do with herself. She wasn't sure she could handle the stress of college or what she'd want to learn there. While in Cleveland, her mother had introduced Abby to a young man in medical school. He was Jewish, from a family the Firestones had known for years. Abby was able to enjoy an evening at the movies, but declined further dates. "If I marry this man, I'll have to live in Cleveland for the rest of my life," she thought. She didn't like Cleveland. She had too many bad memories of seeing doctors and embarrassing incidents. Abby began to sneak out late at night after everyone was asleep. She no longer awakened Natty and barely spoke to her during the day. She didn't tell Natty it was because she was pursuing her own life. She was 19, long past when most girls started dating. Some girls her age were already married. The last trip to Cleveland and the date with the medical student had made up her mind. She was too old to be schlepping back and forth with her mother. Now that she knew what was wrong with her and it had a name, she hoped to get treatment and have a real life like other young women. She wanted to enjoy what was left of her youth. She wanted a life apart from doctors and her cloying mother. She recalled one appointment with a psychiatrist who'd spoken with her while her mother sat in the waiting room. He had been the only doctor to ask her mother to leave the room during the appointment. Her mother had voiced her reluctance. "I'm her mother, and I'm a nurse. I need to hear your diagnosis and what you think about treatment. You have to talk to me, too." "I appreciate your concern for your daughter, Mrs. Leibowitz, but Abby is 19 now. I think it's time she met with a doctor by herself. There's coffee in the waiting room. Please help yourself." Abby had watched her mother go with a mixture of gratitude and anxiety. She'd never been with one of the doctors by herself. But as she'd gotten older, she'd started to value her privacy and often resented her mother's intrusiveness. Now this doctor was confirming that she was an adult and should have some control over her own life. Once her mother had gone, the doctor had pulled up a chair close to Abby's and said in a fatherly tone, "Abby, you're an intelligent young woman. I think your problem is your mother. If you can get away from your mother, you might be all right." "I don't understand what you mean." "I mean that your mother loves you, maybe too much. I think part of why you have the symptoms you have is because she spends too much time with you, and she hasn't let you find your own way or make your own mistakes or decisions." Abby remembered walking out of the doctor's office in a daze. This was an entirely new idea. Could a mother love her child too much? "But I'm not a child anymore. The doctor said so." "What will mother think?" "What shall I tell her? I bet she's angry." Her mother was angry, but not with Abby. "The nerve of that man. Even the doctors I've worked with at the hospital were not that rude. Come on, let's go. I won't stay a minute longer. We'll get some real coffee. Their coffee is swill," her mother said loudly. "You can tell me what he said." They went to a coffee shop nearby. Abby ordered coffee in Danish. Her mother just got coffee. "I'm so angry I could spit," started her mother. "But what about you, honey? Aren't you angry?" asked her mother in a softer tone. Abby was quiet, sipping her coffee between bites of a cinnamon raisin Danish that seemed to melt in her mouth. "Well, I'll tell everyone I know not to go to that doctor," said her mother, raising her voice so the other patrons could hear her. "He said insulin shock might help," replied Abby quietly, afraid to tell her mother the truth. Another idiot, said her mother. I can't believe he told me to leave, and me, a nurse, and your mother. Abby often thought about what the doctor had said. Initially, she was shocked to hear his words stated so blatantly. She'd often wondered if her mother had something to do with her illness, but then she'd wonder why Natty wasn't sick. They both had the same mother. Then her shock turned to anger, especially when her mother told her she should be angry at the doctor. Abby thought, how could anyone say such a thing about mother, who's devoted her life to me, who sacrificed everything to help me get well? Finally, she began to consider the doctor's words in a new light. She couldn't recall a time when mother wasn't nearby. The thought of being on her own frightened and excited her in ways she'd never felt before. What would life be like without mother with me all the time, telling me what to do, where to go, how to act? She wanted to test herself, but events conspired to keep her at home for some time after she returned from Cleveland. She found out where people her age went for fun. Her initial foray took place one night a couple of weeks after she and her mother returned from their recent trip to Cleveland. The stress from the trip had caused a few seizures, one on a street corner in broad daylight while she was running an errand for her mother. Abby was mortified to awaken with several bystanders bending over her. She quickly got to her feet and walked away without thanking anyone or looking back. Mother told her to stay home for a few days and watched her every move. Abby agreed. There was no way she felt well enough mentally or physically to go out on her own. She allowed herself a few days to settle down and get used to being back home. She knew she couldn't handle more than one stressful activity at a time without breaking down. The evening she chose was in the spring, early April. After checking that Natty and her parents were sound asleep, she changed out of her pajamas into a lavender-colored dress her mother had bought for her in Cleveland. She tied one of Daddy's ribbons in her hair and smacked her lips to give them color. She didn't know where Natty kept her lipstick and didn't want to take the chance of waking her to look for it. They were living upstairs again with tenants living downstairs. Abby tiptoed down the stairs and out the front entrance. She had her allowance and a comb in her small black pocketbook. Fortunately, the soda shop stayed open late, so all the kids spilling out from the movie theaters could grab a soda before they and their dates went home. She could walk to the soda shop. Abby was frightened but exhilarated. She walked briskly, holding her pocketbook tightly under her arm like her mother had shown her. The streetlights were bright. She began to feel safe and confident. Over and over, she whispered to herself that she was 19, an adult, free to go where she wanted to go. No one could stop her. Several times, she turned around and started walking back home. Then she whispered calming words to herself. It's just the soda shop. You'll have a soda and go home. Easy. As soon as she felt calm, she turned back toward the soda shop. During her walk, she had to stop and lean against a lamppost a couple of times to gather strength to complete the journey. For Abby, this was not merely a trip to the soda shop. It was a trip outside into the real world, unpopulated by clinics, hospitals, doctors, and her mother. Until recently, they had offered comfort and solace when she was not being poked, prodded, or questioned. They were all she knew. She'd never felt truly comfortable at home nor in Cleveland. She was never with relatives in Cleveland long enough to feel close to them, and they'd all seemed frightened when she had an incident. She could see it on all their faces except her grandmother's. She had learned how to console her. Mother could no longer make Abby feel protected or cherished. Now, Abby associated her mother with constant travel and anxiety. Each doctor's office, clinic, or hospital was different from the others, but they had certain attributes in common. They smelled a certain way, which she associated with people who told her they cared about her. She found some comfort in the squeaking sounds made by the nurses' shoes as they walked the concrete floors. There was a process used in each setting that gave rhythm to Abby's visits. She was always greeted in the waiting room, first like a child, more recently like an adult with childlike behaviors. She noticed the difference. A nurse in a crisp white uniform always took her vital signs and asked how she was feeling. She was asked to don a cloth gown and sit on a gurney to await the doctor. Her gurney was usually lined up along a hallway with other gurneys filled with female patients awaiting their turns with the doctor or their discharge home. While she waited, Mother chatted with Abby about mundane things and tried to offer reassurance. As Abby got older, she was not reassured by her mother's chatter. She would have preferred Mother to wait outside, but she had used her influence as a nurse to gain access that relatives of other patients didn't have. When it was Abby's turn to see the doctor, the nurse always chatted with her as she and her mother escorted Abby into the doctor's office. If the doctor was not going to examine her body, then she was allowed to walk into the doctor's office in her street clothes. She preferred that, as she was self-conscious about her body, comparing herself to what she imagined lay beneath the gowns of the other female patients. Sometimes the doctor seemed to examine her more than Abby thought necessary, especially as she got older. But her mother never stopped them or spoke. She had been trained that the doctor was always right and knew what was best. She seemed to trust their examinations, even if she later mistrusted their diagnoses and recommendations for treatment. Now Abby was simply trying to do what every other girl her age was doing. Going to the soda shop seemed like a normal activity for a girl her age. Why was it so hard? She wondered. Because she was intentionally starting a new phase of her life, she told herself. She had made the decision to go. She had a plan, and now was executing that plan. She began to resent her mother for making this so hard. Natty seemed to go everywhere without fear. She had a bunch of friends. Abby heard a rumor that Natty was dating someone. Abby didn't want to be sick. Is it possible Mother made me sick, like the doctor said? Abby's resentment turned to her father. Why couldn't we be rich? What is he doing wrong? Like Natty, Abby often wondered about the plaque in the living room that said Harry Leibowitz, ESQ, attorney at law. Why is he working in a garden tool shop? Why didn't he ever go to Cleveland with us? Doesn't he care about my illness? Sometimes on their trips in the evening when they were preparing for bed in some motel or boarding house, her mother spoke to Abby about her life and her marriage. Abby was too old for bedtime stories. Her mother thought these stories might calm Abby into a restful sleep. She was unaware they'd done the opposite. Frequently, after hearing the stories, Abby lay awake for hours replaying them in her head. Her mother told Abby how she'd met Abby's father and fell in love with him, but soon discovered he was not who or what she'd thought he was. It's just as easy to marry a rich man as a poor one, Abby, my darling. Don't forget that. I thought your father would make money and we would be comfortable. But you see how poor we are. Your uncles are very generous to us. We should be thankful, said Mother one such evening. She told Abby about the finality of her father's decision to stop practicing law. Mother began telling her the story Daddy had told her many years ago. She'd reached the point in the story when her father had left the police station. Your father was disappointed because he had not heard anything from Detective Wasserman after his visit. He decided to go back to the police station. First, he and Ryan Murphy met together to talk to the district attorney. Ryan and Harry were surprised when the DA greeted them in the lobby at the appointed time and directed them into his office. He spoke before either Ryan or Harry could say anything. Gentlemen, I know why you're here. There's nothing I can do. You're just wasting your time and mine, he said, blocking the seat so neither of them could sit down. But sir, began Ryan, please hear us out at least. I have a very busy day, Mr. Murphy. Please let me get on with it. Ryan and Harry left the DA's office, shared a few words about being in touch soon, and hats in hands, so angry they couldn't say any more, went their separate ways without a word. Harry went to the police station, where he was told by the desk sergeant that Detective Wasserman was out on a call. but he could wait. Harry sat down on a bench near the station door, watching people come and go. He'd always been a people watcher. Police officers in fading blue uniforms with worn buttons moved swiftly in and out in contrast to the plainclothes police, who seemed to move more languidly. Harry assumed they were plainclothes police officers or detectives, because they spoke with authority to the desk sergeant, who sat up a little straighter when they approached his desk that loomed over everyone. The uniformed policemen sometimes pushed, sometimes dragged men whom Harry assumed were criminals or alleged criminals. They were only slightly gentler, with an occasional alleged woman criminal. These Harry differentiated from the rare woman in a smart suit or dress with matching hat perched precariously on stiff, perfumed hair. No one pushed or pulled those women. One walked in clearly nervous about what she was doing there or whom to talk to about her troubles. Another marched right up to one of those office doors and knocked loudly. There was a lot of noise and bustle in the station. Men talked in loud, gruff voices. The air was smoky from cigarettes and smelled like unwashed clothes and urine. When Harry got tired of people watching and the dirty looks from the desk sergeant, he opened the newspaper he'd brought along, anticipating a long wait. There on the front page was a photo of the juror who told Ryan he'd been threatened to vote for an innocent verdict in the Ash Weisskopf case. Harry had barely scanned the photo when Wasserman sauntered through the precinct door. He must not have seen Harry sitting near the entrance. His eyes were directed to the desk and the desk sergeant. Wasserman walked over to the sergeant's desk. Harry saw the desk sergeant point at him and whisper to Wasserman. The detective bent his head down, heaved an exasperated sigh, and turned around to motion Harry to follow him to his office. "Mr. Leibowitz, what brings you back here on this fine day? I thought I told you we'd call you if we needed you." Wasserman opened the office door, allowing Harry to enter only just past the threshold. Wasserman's hand remained on the doorknob with the door slightly ajar. He looked run down and ragged. It was mid-afternoon. He'd been working for several hours straight without a break. Wasserman moved around Harry to reach his desk. He lit a cigarette but didn't offer one to Harry. "I remember that, Detective Wasserman. I came here to speak with you directly to see if there were any updates. But I just happened to see the front page while waiting for you." Harry stood just inside the office, aware Wasserman had no patience for him, and he'd probably get nowhere with him. He held his hat in his hand. He handed the newspaper to the detective. "I don't know anything about it. There's another detective assigned to the case. But don't go bothering him. He's got enough on his plate right now, just like me." Wasserman turned toward his desk and gestured to the paper scattered all over its surface. "Doesn't make sense. I reported my concern to you more than a month ago and nothing happened. Now I see a photo in the paper of a dead man. The same man I told you about." "What are you implying, Mr. Leibowitz? You're on shaky ground here, walking into my office, practically accusing me of murder." Wasserman was in a rage, bawling his fists and banging the one without the lit cigarette on the table. "You get out of here right now, or I'll bring you up on charges. You hear me good." "Charges? What charges? I've not accused you of anything. But it's interesting that you should suggest such an accusation." Before Harry could say more, Wasserman pushed Harry out the door and quickly closed it, catching the edge of Harry's jacket. Harry, trembling with shock and anger, opened the door to retrieve his one good suit jacket and moved quickly toward the station exit. He set his hat firmly in place and strode angrily up the avenue. Before her mother could go on with the story, Abby clutched the sides of her head. "I don't want to hear any more about this. It's too upsetting, and it happened ages ago. Tell me why you became a nurse." Her mother wasn't surprised at the sudden change in the direction of conversation. Abby had learned to manipulate interactions because everyone around her worried she'd have an incident if they didn't indulge her moods. Her mother quickly switched gears to tell Abby she went to nursing school against her parents' wishes. Nice Jewish girls didn't touch people's bodies or clean up after them, she said. From an early age, Rose explained, she felt the need to take care of others. Her own mother frequently took care of sick neighbors and friends, but stopped short of the intimacies required of nurses. Mother told Abby she liked being praised for her kindness and seeing people get well because of her ministrations. So Rose ignored her parents' objections, saying she wanted to be useful and wasn't ready to marry and settle down. I was 17 when I enrolled in the nursing program, Mother continued. We wore ankle-length cotton dresses, blue with thin white stripes, white stockings and garters, and sturdy white shoes. The first probie year was brutal, especially for a young girl who'd been pampered all her life. But I loved it. We lived in a dormitory overseen by a strict, no-nonsense house mother. Men who came to visit had strict visiting hours and could not go beyond the first floor reception area. I made such good friends there, she said wistfully, no longer looking at her daughter. Rose felt herself drifting back to that happier time. We worked 12 hours a day, she resumed. Within a year, we were running the hospital on the night shift. Now, as Abby walked to the soda shop, she remembered her mother's attempts to calm her by talking about her time in nursing school. It was the first time Abby realized Mother had had a life before she was born. She'd heard her parents' stories and the tales of her grandparents shared about their years in Budapest, but they had seemed like stories that weren't real. She wondered if they ever felt as isolated as she did at that moment. She finally reached the threshold of the soda shop. Kids were milling around outside, some smoking cigarettes. Boys and girls were flirting with each other and laughing. The laughter sounded so wonderful to Abby, who couldn't remember the last time she really laughed because she felt joyful. No one blocked her as she walked toward the counter. A few of the boys even winked and smiled at her. "Hello, kiddo," called one boy sitting on a stool by the counter. "Buy you a soda?" She smiled, but otherwise ignored him. She didn't know how to behave. Maybe she should have asked Natty how to talk to boys or what to do if they spoke to her. Soon, she was beginning to feel better, telling herself she was just like everyone else, perhaps even prettier than some of the girls there. The shop was crowded. She moved through the cliques of kids to the counter and ordered an egg cream. He got up off his stool and gestured for her to sit down. She smiled at him shyly and sat to survey the room. Music was playing in the background. Some kids were dancing. She watched with envy, unable to imagine herself as one of them, brave enough to dance in front of everyone. She was making a supreme effort to be normal, sit normally, look normal, and when her egg cream arrived, pay as everyone else would, and eat it without spilling or shaking. Abby sipped it while watching the kids around her. The first boy had given up, but a couple of other boys made an effort to talk with her. She put her head down and focused on the fizzy drink. After a few moments, Abby began to feel her energy waning and fatigue setting in. The effort to control herself was tiring, but she was proud to have made it this far on her own. She stood, clutching her purse to her chest, and made her way back through the kids dancing and milling about, out through the open door to where kids were still laughing and smoking, some singing to the music inside. Abby walked away quickly, this time without hesitation, for she was heading home.